is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
There's nothing better than receiving the phone call about the kid getting their degree, the kid, you know, getting engaged, getting married, getting a big job. Can I use you as a reference? You know, and those are where you realize that you're really winning and you're really doing it the right way.
Doug Brotherton has coached for 16 years and is in his eighth year at the helm of the Village School Girls Varsity Basketball program in Houston, Texas. Coach Brotherton's coaching career started at Shepherd High School, where he became the youngest varsity coach in the state of Michigan, before leading the program to their first playoff win in 31 years. After four successful years of coaching at Shepherd High School, Coach Brotherton accepted the head coaching position at Mid-Michigan Community College. At MMCC, Brotherton built the men's basketball program. In two short seasons, the Lakers were already ranked as the number two junior college men's basketball team in the state of Michigan. Coach Brotherton's next job was at the Village School. In his 6 years, the Lady Vikings have never had a varsity player academically ineligible, including 10 academic All-State players in the past 3 years. The varsity team also increased their win total in each of his first 5 seasons. The Village Lady Vikings have averaged 25 wins per season over the past 3 years, while being a mainstay in the top 10 of the large private school state rankings. Brotherton is also very involved at all levels of basketball. He spent 2 seasons as an NBA regional scout for the Chicago Bulls. He is a content contributor for Fast Model Sports and the founder of Dynamic Coaching Tools, which provides resources, content, events, and services to help empower coaches to thrive in today's competitive coaching landscape. In 2018, Coach Brotherton was a national winner of the Positive Coaching Alliance Double Goal Coach Award, which honors 50 coaches from around the country for their positive impact on the court and in the lives of young people. Brotherton was also elected to the Texas Association of Basketball Coaches Large Private School Board. The past 3 summers, Doug developed the Jay Billis Camp Coaches Packet, which is used for the coaching development program, and he also worked Snow Valley Camps in Iowa. If you enjoy this episode, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. Make sure you're subscribed to the Hoopheads podcast so you don't miss an episode, and tell a friend or colleague in the basketball community to give us a listen. The Hoopheads pod is available on all the major podcast apps. Grab a pen and paper so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Doug Brotherton from the Village School in Houston, Texas. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Doug Brotherton, the assistant athletic director and head girls varsity basketball coach at the Village School in Houston, Texas. He's also the founder of Dynamic Coaching Tools. We met this summer at the Jay Billis Skills Camp. Doug, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to talk some basketball.
For sure. It's going to be fun to dig into your story, learn a little bit more about your background. You've done a lot of interesting things over the course of your career, including what you're doing now. So I can't wait to dig into all that. Let's start out by going backwards in time to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if it was so much at first basketball or just competition. You know, my dad was one of four boys. I've got, you know, two brothers and, you know, one brother that's 2 years apart. And I just felt like growing up, we were always competing. You know, we were always jumping into trying to figure out how to score anything and everything that we could do in the backyard and in the driveway. And obviously growing up at a time, both my parents are from Illinois when, you know, Michael Jordan was, you know, coming through the NBA and setting the world on fire. It was just something that I just started to really fall in love with. And then as I got into elementary school, we were in a small rural town, Marshall, Michigan, and I joined a travel basketball team with some guys in the third grade and, you know, ended up playing with that same core group of guys all the way through high school. And a lot of those guys became my best friends and, you know, had a high school basketball coach that was really impactful. And so basketball just continued to evolve. And, you know, I think it really shaped a lot of who I am. And a lot of our, you know, values came from athletics and different sports, but basketball was the one that just kind of stuck and was what I was most passionate about.
All right. So two things. One, you mentioned that you're playing a whole bunch of sports growing up as a young kid. You know, obviously today there's a lot of talk about specialization and the impact that has on whether it's injury, skill development, burnout, however you want to look at it. So when you look back on your time, your childhood, thinking about playing multiple sports, again, whether you played them at the scholastic level or not, but just playing them in the backyard with your brothers or kids in the neighborhood, talk a little bit about how you feel that had an impact on you just as your development as a competitor.
Yeah, it was really important. And it's something I think that as adults, we need to continue to push on young people, you know, just different ways to compete, getting yourself in different environments, developing different skills mentally and physically. And so I do think it was really impactful. You know, we jumped into a little bit of everything. I did the T-ball when I was young and played baseball up through middle school, played soccer in high school, played some football growing up, did cross country for a year in high school, played obviously basketball 4 years. And I just like to compete. And I think that, you know, in our town, being a rural town in Michigan, most of us played multiple sports. And, you know, we ended up on our high school team alone with a kid that played quarterback at Notre Dame and some professional baseball, another kid that, you know, ended up playing Division I basketball and had a tremendous career. And so, you know, I don't think that it hindered any of those guys' ability to go have tremendous athletic careers by being involved in, you know, two, three, and four sports. The more competition, the better.
Yeah, it's an interesting way that basketball and all sports have shifted today in today's world, where it's really, I think it's really difficult in some places to play. Certainly the three sport athlete is sort of becoming a dinosaur. It's really, really difficult to do. And in a lot of places, I think even the two sport athlete sometimes, unless you're, you know, talking about maybe a fall sport and a spring sport where the seasons don't overlap at all, it's getting really difficult. And I think that's something that we're doing a disservice to kids on a lot of levels from what you described with the competition and just the camaraderie of being a part of multiple teams. But also I just think that the experience of getting to be exposed to different coaches, different teammates, I think all those things benefit you in the long run. And I know that I look back on my own athletic career, and I only played basketball when I was in high school, but growing up as a young kid, I played everything. I mean, I was out on the football field in the backyard playing tackle football. I was on the baseball diamond, and I played a lot of tennis. And I think all those things helped me to be a better athlete. And they also helped me just as a person learning how to get along with other people and be a leader and organize games and put things together. And I think that's something that kids today, unfortunately, I think they miss out on that. And I don't think we're ever going back to that, but I think that there's something to be said for encouraging kids to play multiple sports as they come up through their scholastic careers, for sure.
Yeah, I think the first question from adults needs to be, do you want to play? And that's to me, that's what gets lost. You know, you start immediately, we want to jump in and say, well, you're going to miss workouts. You're going to miss that. You're going to get rusty. Do you want to play? And if a kid wants to play, they shouldn't. And, you know, I know for our program down here in Houston, any kid that wants to be a multi-sport athlete can do it. And we have, you know, four kids on our roster with Division I scholarship offers. And if they want to go play another sport, go do it. And my thought is this, if it's a Tuesday night in the fall, I'd rather have that kid uncomfortable in the middle of a volleyball match, trying to figure out, you know, in a 24 to 22 set, how to make a play under pressure and something that they're not real confident in, as opposed to sitting at home, you know, not doing anything very productive. And we're still going to be able to have plenty of time to improve their basketball game and do those different things. But the other part where it's really impactful is from a leadership standpoint. You know, in that kid's specialized sport, they're going to be very comfortable to lead a team and have a lot of conviction and confidence as they deliver a message. All of a sudden, you put those kids in a secondary sport and they have to learn how to be followers. Anybody who's ran a team, a company, or anything else knows it's every bit as important that you have kids who know how to be followers so that leader can be empowered to kind of fight and develop your culture. And so I think that's something that gets lost a lot. You end up with 8 kids on your team that specialize in a sport and they all want to be a leader and nobody knows how to, you know, listen and help kind of drive what you're trying to get done.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that when you play a different sport, yeah, maybe I'm the basketball star, but when I'm on the volleyball team, I'm just an average player. Or when I'm on the softball team, I'm just an average player. And that allows me to learn how to be that in that different role. And you know, I'm not the star. Maybe I'm the role player here. Or maybe I'm the bench player who doesn't play, who just provides, you know, a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and work ethic and makes the starters better in practice. And I think those are, again, things that, as you said, they don't just apply to sports. They apply to life outside of sports. And I know that you were fortunate enough to be selected for the Positive Coaching Alliance's Double Goal Coach Award. And PCA is something that I've been involved in for the past several years as a trainer. And I just believe in the philosophies. And you think about how they talk about making better athletes, but also better people. And ultimately, that's really what it's all about for us as coaches. It has to be about the long-term success of the kids that we are charged with working with, and not just long-term successes on the field or on the court, but you want them to be successful in whatever it is that they end up in. So talk a little bit about that PCA mentality that you bring to your coaching style.
Yeah, it was that whole opportunity was really amazing. I mean, I think the best part about the award is knowing that you're nominated by somebody and, you know, obviously they follow up with other people to find more information. And so it truly was just an honor to know that, you know, you're making an impact, and that's what we all aim to do. And so for us, it, you know, we talk a lot about core values and culture in our program. We have a program guidebook that we live by. The first day of every season, whether you're a senior and you're doing it for the fourth time, or, you know, you're a freshman just jumping in, we go through our program guidebook and what's important to us and our culture and our core values and what we're about before we take the floor. And one of the main core values, we have 3 of them, and then we have an annual one that we rotate, is servant leadership. And so that's what was really exciting about that, is as much as you hear, you know, words like culture, words like servant leadership, different phrases, trust the process, you know, bounce around. It was just wonderful to know that there were people that, you know, believed that was something that we were representing. And, you know, anytime you have an opportunity to win an award, it goes out to a lot of different people. And I've been really fortunate to have amazing mentors that taught me a lot of those values. And I think with PCA, they just do a really good job of stressing the way that you can make an impact beyond winning and losing. But they also do acknowledge that as coaches, we're all really competitive and we want to help our kids succeed. But it was just a really neat experience. I got to go spend time with some great coaches and learn. You know, that's one thing that my wife was laughing about. We're sitting there and, you know, supposed to be just being honored and enjoying, and you could tell everybody at the table, at each of the tables, was a learn it all. We're all like asking each other questions,
trying to see
if we can go back. And I think that's part of the reason why we were all there.
So when, in going through that process, I'm just curious how it worked. Did you end up finding out, did you know who nominated you?
I did find out. Yeah, I actually asked. I just was curious, and I was able to you know, find out a few people who talked to us. And it's actually our current athletic director at our school. And so she nominated me, and then we had, you know, some former players and former assistant coaches that, you know, wrote and said some nice things along the way. And it was just really special. Like I said, I mean, you're going to hear me use core values and culture a lot, but relationships is one of the most important one of our core values. And you know, that was what I was really proud of. But going through the process was neat. I found out actually they sent an email and posted it online. And so it was just, it was kind of a whirlwind when it first happened, you know, and just trying to figure out who the heck I needed to go thank. You know,
right.
That's really what it was. I just had a whole lot of gratitude. And wanted to share that with the people who I had those relationships with. It was really cool.
All right. So you mentioned a minute or two ago when you were talking about your high school career, and you talked a little bit about the impact that your high school coach had on you. And I'm assuming that impact not only impacted you as a player, but to go along with our discussion that we're having now, impacted you as you move forward into your coaching career. So can you talk about maybe one or two things from your high school coach that you still carry with you today that are important in your coaching philosophy or just in the way that you go about handling your program that you learned from your high school days?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, so Coach Coddins is now the athletic director at Marshall High School and was my high school coach. And he did a fantastic job of developing a level of trust that allowed him to be kind of screw the consequences honest. You know, whether you loved him or disliked him, as you walked out of the gym that day, you knew that he genuinely cared about you and you knew you were getting his honest opinion, you know, and that's something that's, I really can't express how important that is. And he's someone that I know that I still to this day can pick up the phone and call and explain what's going on and then know that he won't hold any punches. You know, he's going to let you know exactly what's going on. And so, you know, trying to do that with our players to be able to develop that relationship in a way that allows me to be really, really honest with them and tell them what they need to hear, not what they want to hear, you know. And then the other thing that he's done a great job of is just the way that he has so many former players, but I might hear from him if I don't reach out, you know, once every few months, but he finds a way to still reach out and just check in and, you know, kind of keep that connection there. And so when I went to college, I got a coaching job coaching freshman girls, really, you know, really young in college, and didn't send him my schedule. To this day, I don't know how he got the schedule, but we're riding back on the bus and my phone rings and he's asking how the game went. You know, my brother played for him 2 years after me and is getting married in Virginia Beach, and Coddins hops in his, you know, car and drives from Michigan to Virginia Beach to be at the wedding. You know, there's just, it's the things that he did. What we all talk about with him has very little to do with basketball. You know, he was big on toughness, discipline, accountability, but he had a special knack for being able to create a relationship that allowed him to, you know, push you beyond your comfort level in a way that made you better.
So how, to me, like just hearing you say those, given those examples of the relationship that you and obviously your brother and your family was able to build with him, what strikes me there is that for him to be able to do that, and I'm sure that no matter how special your relationship was with him, I'm sure that he's not just doing that with you. I'm sure he's doing that with multiple players over the course of his career. So I guess as I'm listening to that, what strikes me is how intentional he has to be about staying in contact with his former players. And I think that that's something that if you think about your impact as a coach and what you really want to do, that connection after your players are gone and those relationships that you build are really, to me, that's what it's all about. And I think that there sounds like there was no better role model for some of the things that you've now described as being part of your culture than what you were able to see modeled from your high school coach.
Absolutely. And I think it's important for coaches to understand, if you really want to measure your impact, not your ability to coach basketball or coach whatever respective sports you're in, you got to get beyond the moment and see what it looks like 5 to 10 years later. And I've coached now for 15 years, and this is something I'm just now learning and experiencing, but there's nothing better than receiving the phone call about the kid getting their degree, the kid, getting engaged, getting married, getting a big job. Can I use you as a reference? And those are where you realize that you're really winning and you're really doing it the right way. You have that satisfaction when you win a big game or you win a league title, and all those things are wonderful. And, we're really happy and proud of the kids. And in the moment we feel really good, but if you're doing it right, it takes some time for you to really be able to appreciate the impact that we have as coaches and how lucky we are to do what we do.
Yeah, there's no question. I've said it a couple times on the podcast here, but I think one of the things that we sometimes as coaches take for granted or don't always think about is the impact that our words or our actions can have on kids. And sometimes those words and actions don't have an impact in the moment. Sometimes they don't have an impact during that season. Sometimes they don't even have an impact 3 years or 5 years down the road. Sometimes it's 10 years down the road where suddenly a light comes on or a player remembers something that you said, and it's probably more than likely something that you don't even remember saying yourself that have the biggest impact. I know I can speak to that from me being a player standpoint. I still remember certain things that my coaches would have told me or said to me that I carry with me today that still, whether it's inspire me, whether it makes me think about the type of person I was when I was playing, and just makes me think about the relationship that I was able to build with the coaches, that I can remember some of the things they said. And again, if I went back and told them about, hey, do you remember when you told me such and such, they would probably look at me, a little cross-eyed like I was crazy and probably not remember it. But it's something that's very important for us coaches to remember, is that those words that we use and those things that we do, they not only have an impact in that moment, but they have an impact long down the road with all of our players.
Yes, 100%. And, to that point, I think it's really interesting how some of that stuff plays out. You talked about not knowing in the moment. So we were together at the Jay Billis camp, and there was a young man in the coaching development program that came up to me and asked if I knew a young man by the name of Brandon. I'll leave his last name out just for the sake of taking care of him. But when I was coaching at Mid-Michigan Community College up in, up there and kind of trying to start that program from scratch, Brandon came to us, and for whatever reason, whether it was him trying to mature or just a disconnect there, I just wasn't the voice that was going to impact him the right way, and was trying to get through to him, and there was just a disconnect there. And so, I ended up telling him a few weeks into the season that clearly I wasn't going to be the person to help drive him towards whatever success he was looking for, and that I thought it was time for him to move on. And we ended up removing him from the program and encouraged him to keep his grades up, still did grade and class checks with him. And I told him, when the time comes, if you do what you're supposed to academically and you show some progress, I'll help you find another place to play next year. And we did that. And he, to his credit, was phenomenal in, deciding that he was going to figure it out. And I'm walking down the hallway, and young guy walks up to me and asks if I know Brandon. And I just kind of smiled and said, yeah, of course I know him. And, he played for me in Michigan, and he had moved to the Charlotte area, and mentioned to his friend when his friend told me he was coming to the camp to find me and tell me thank you. And it's funny, I'm getting thanked for kicking a kid out of a program. But to your point, you never know the impact. And whereas I wasn't the right person to change him, just being honest with the kid and letting him know that, not worrying about the fact that he might have helped us win an extra two or three games, ended up being the right thing for him to move on. And he ended up finding a coach that mentored him and really changed his life.
Right. And maybe you changed it. I mean, you changed his trajectory. You may have just bumped him, kind of like the airliner that's going, goes 1 degree off course. And over the course of time, that can make a huge difference in where that airplane ends up. And I think that's almost how what that situation that you're describing there with Brandon is. He was going down one path, and maybe if he had stayed in your program, he might not have righted the ship. Who knows?
Yeah.
Just by bumping him in another direction, he was able to eventually find the place that was the right place for him. And sounds like he's been able to have some success and attributes that some, in some small way to you, which, as you said, you probably never would have, had that conversation never taken place down there in Charlotte this year. You probably would have never had any idea that that had an impact on that young man and that he was able to have, he was able to have success. Yeah. I think that's, again, like I said, it's something that if you're a coach out there listening, you know, don't take that for granted. Don't take that responsibility lightly, because the kids are always watching. They're always listening. They know. And, you know, if you're a parent, you certainly know that. I know my kids come up with stuff that I said 2 or 3 years ago that, you know, I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't remember saying that, you know, but they remember that stuff, and they remember the good. And sometimes, unfortunately, they remember the bad occasionally too. So it's, you never know what you're getting from your kids.
Yeah. I can relate.
All right. So let's jump back a minute to, talk a little bit about the coaching profession, and just at what point did you start thinking that, okay, I want to stay involved in the game of basketball. I want to be a coach. Was that something that was always on your mind from the time you were young? Was it something that didn't hit you until you were done playing? Just talk about how the genesis of your coaching career kind of began.
Yeah, I think it really started. So the Chicago Bulls, clearly weren't great at evaluating talent, because they weren't looking for a 6'1" slow mediocre jump shooter. And so I had to hang that up. And so I had some opportunities to play small college basketball close to my hometown. And it was once again my high school coach. I wanted to coach, and he was a student manager when he was in college. And so you know, I was looking at a few different schools in Michigan, and Central Michigan offered me an opportunity to be a student manager and be involved and learn. And so that was really the moment when I realized I wanted to coach, was as I got into college and was a student manager and missed playing and missed the competition. I ended up finding that freshman girls basketball job in a town right by Central Michigan in Shepherd, Michigan, and jumped in early and had an athletic director there that had been a basketball coach that saw something there and was able to, a couple years later, be the varsity girls coach at that school while in college. But it was just being a student manager and being around the game and just really kind of seeing and enjoying it that I think was when it really solidified that was the route I was going
to
go.
So how did you balance, how'd you find the time to be able to do all three? So be a student manager for the basketball team and coach this JV girls team. How did you make all that work?
The coaches were great at Central Michigan. I mean, I wasn't the head manager. My roommate was. And so I would get there when I could. And they were really good about it. I mean, you know, I think that it was actually, there was a point in time. So I was under two coaches there that were totally different, which was a true blessing. I mean, I was under Jay Smith, who was a motion offense guy, one of the best post player coaches I've been around even to this day. And then Ernie Ziegler came in, and he had been at UCLA and had a ton of success and was really good at teaching the defensive end and ran a bunch of sets. And so I got both of those things. Well, while I was there with Ernie, you know, I had the opportunity to become the varsity girls coach, but at the same time, our manager that was also over being the video coordinator was graduating. And so there was a chance to do some of that stuff. And I remember coming back, we went to Morehead State and won on a buzzer beater. And so Coach Ziegler was in a great mood. And I asked him on the bus if I could talk to him and just told him, I have a chance to go here and be the girls varsity coach, but I don't want to let you down. And he said, look, if you can run a program at any point, go run a program and learn and figure it out. And so it really was just people being understanding. And, you know, I'm going to be really repetitive here, but just having good mentors is really important. And both of those guys and the assistant coaches on those staffs were really good to me about being understanding and knowing I was having a chance to do more. You know, being a student manager is wonderful. You learn, you absorb, you're a sponge, but you're not coaching on the floor. You're not getting to make mistakes and kind of have the necessary trial and error that you need to develop. And so they encouraged it and allowed me to figure that out.
As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game. All right, a couple things. One, so we have another piece of shared history that I guess I didn't realize as we were when we talked down at Billa. So Jay Smith was an assistant at Kent my freshman year.
Okay.
When I was there. So Jay left after my freshman year. He left and went to the University of Michigan. And then obviously eventually he ended up there at Central. So shared story there. I really liked Jay when he was there as an assistant at Kent. He was young at the time. Again, he probably was younger, older, I'm not sure, than what I, you know, what my perception of him was at that point was that he was a fairly, you know, fairly young assistant. And then, you know, eventually moved on, like I said, to University of Michigan, but I always enjoyed my time with him. So I can certainly relate to why you felt like he was a good guy to work under. Yeah. And then my second point or second question for you is, when you first jumped into that student manager position, were there some things that you found out about coaching or that you learned that maybe you didn't realize before, kind of on the outside? Because I think when you come from the player side of it, now suddenly you're jumping in, especially at the Division I level, I'm guessing there were some things that maybe you didn't realize that the coaching staff did, or the amount of time that they spent on certain things. Was there anything that was surprising to you as you took that manager job and kind of got a behind the scenes look at what being a college coach was all about?
I think that it's funny. I didn't appreciate it at the time. You know, it was just kind of frustrating, but looking back at it, we really struggled. I mean, when I think in the last couple of years there that Jay was there, I think we won 8 games in 4 games or maybe it was 12-4, but really struggled. I mean, they were long years and then when, you know, Ernie came in, Coach Ziegler, he's trying to build it up. And I actually think that was really a blessing as a young guy trying to figure out coaching, because you got to see how difficult it really is to create shared buy-in, to, you know, get players to embrace kind of the repetitiveness of the process of getting better and building a program, and got to see where, you know, at times there was some divide. And so, you know, Jay Smith won, you know, some MAC championships and, you know, won an NCAA tournament game and had some success at Central Michigan. And I wasn't there during that time. And I remember being there and wishing, like, man, I wish Kamen were here when I was here.
Right. Like, right.
Yep. And that would have been awesome. And, but I look back at it now and it, you know, really did benefit my development to see coaching staffs, you know, looking for answers. You know, we weren't just, it was being able to sit and be a fly on the wall in coaches' meetings and listen to the coaches bounce ideas off each other. And, you know, when it's mid-January and you're struggling, hey, how can we get these guys to bring some energy today? And so I think that was really the thing that surprised me, and that, you know, there's no way I could have been prepared or be able to expect it when I was in high school. It was the complete other way. You know, my friends and I were fortunate enough to have quite a bit of talent. We had a good high school program and a good coach. And so I think we lost 7 games total in the 4 years that we were in high school. And so I hadn't seen the other side of it. And that was really, really valuable, because every place that I've coached, whether it be Shepherd High School taking over that program as a young guy, or Mid-Michigan Community College was no athletics for 40 years and starting a men's basketball program from scratch, or coming down here to Village, where we only had 6 girls in the whole high school that played, had never played a full varsity schedule. We're thinking about getting rid of girls basketball. And so every single one of those spots was truly a build. And so, being able to be there to experience that as a young guy, was great. I mean, it was wonderful. You just don't realize it while you're in it. You just want to taste success so bad.
You want to win some games, right? You can learn a little bit from losing, but it's nice to win a little bit too.
Yeah. And everybody's in a little bit better mood when you show
sure.
up.
no doubt about that. It's funny, 'cause you know, when I played, I never really, you know, as a player, you're kind of, you're so singularly focused, first of all, on your own individual performance and just trying to be the best that you can be. And then secondarily, you're worried about your team performance and trying to figure all that stuff out. And I guess I never looked at, I always had great relationships with all the guys that were managers. But I never really looked at that when I was playing. I never really looked at that as necessarily a coaching track. It just never really was something that crossed my mind. I guess I never had that conversation with the guys who were, you know, who were managers. And there are one or two of them that have ended up going on to coaching and others that are doing other things besides the coaching profession. But I just, it's interesting that it never crossed my mind that, hey, maybe these guys are doing this because eventually they want to coach. And you just think about the amount of access that you have as a student to be able to be, whether it's in the coaches meetings or on the road trips or just, you know, you think about all that and really, you know, you compare being a player to being a manager in terms of preparing you to be a coach. And if you would have asked me when I was 23, which one was a better preparation for being a coach, I would have told you, oh, a player, it's not even close. But if I look at it now, you know, I think that the advantages of guys who are able to get into a program like you were and be able to work closely with those coaches and develop relationships and be behind the scenes. And yeah, maybe you're not coaching on the floor the way you might if you were coaching a JV team, but just to be able to see, and as you said, be a fly on the wall and see what goes on, the amount of learning that you're able to do. And then again, just the connections to have relationships with guys who, in your case, were Division I head coaches, and those networks that they've opened up to you to be able to tap into as you go on in your career. I just always find it interesting that I, for some reason, whatever reason that is, it just never crossed my mind that the student manager track towards being a coach was just one that I never really thought of or considered. I want you to go back to the time when you get that first JV girls coaching job and think about where you were then, think about where you are now, and talk about one or two things that you look back on and you say, wow, I am so much better at this today than I was that first day I walked through the gym doors and faced my team for the first time.
Yeah. I cringe thinking back to, you know, to the early days of jumping into coaching. I think the main reason is when you first get into coaching, the biggest challenge is being confident and comfortable enough to be authentic and be yourself. And so, you know, I think that here I am, I'm a student manager at the Division I level in a tough season, you know, yelling, screaming, trying to motivate, like all that stuff that you see at the Division I men's level. And then I go into the freshman girls basketball team at Shepherd High School, and I'm trying to do that. You know, like I'd laugh at some of the stuff, but like I said, I had an athletic director that helped me through it. And she always says that my passion's what, you know, helped cover up a lot of my inexperience and my mistakes, because I just wanted to help the kids get better and I wanted the program to get better. But that'd be the biggest difference. I think just naturally with experience and going through it, kids have a really special ability to smell BS. You know, they immediately can tell when someone's being fake and they're not really being themselves, and you lose a lot of credibility. And so thankfully there wasn't, you know, social media and a whole lot of film being done with freshman girls basketball back in the day. Cause if I had to watch myself in a practice, that would be pretty scary. Just cause like I said, I wasn't confident and comfortable in who I was as a coach. And, you know, I was still in a player's mindset of, you know, this shouldn't be hard, just do this, and not really knowing how to teach. I was really good at telling and not teaching. And I think that's the evolution, as you do it more, as you become a better teacher, and then, you know, naturally get better with your messaging and kind of what's important to you and what your non-negotiables are.
So as you progressed over, starting obviously with the JVs, and eventually you're able to take over that entire program as the varsity coach, so talk a little bit about that process, how it came to be. And then obviously when you get that job, it's your first opportunity to really put your stamp on an entire program. So maybe talk a little bit about just what you had in mind at that time what you wanted to build your program on? What were the pillars that you were going to put together? And maybe we'll eventually get to, you know, how that might be different from where you are now in your coaching career. But just talk about how you went about getting that job and then the steps you took to build the program and kind of the image that you wanted.
Yeah, there was a really good group of kids that came up, and I that was the first team I ever coached. And so we had some success. Honestly, some of those kids probably should have been moved up, you know, but the group was kept together. And so the varsity coach still, you know, is in the community that I worked under at first, but had a family, wanted to kind of focus on that. And so the job came open, and some of those families went to the athletic director. I mean, I was the youngest coach in the state at the time. I think I was 20 years old when I got hired to that varsity position and 21 when the season started. And it probably helped a little bit in that particular job that I was young and didn't know what I didn't know, because the program in the 3 years before I took over had won 5 games combined and had not won a playoff game in 31 years. And, you know, Mike, mind you, in Michigan, everybody makes the playoffs and it's not seeded. Like, you go to your meeting and you draw a school's name out of a hat. And like, we couldn't find someone in 31 years. And so I go in there and, you know, I had a group that trusted me, cause I had, you know, those kids at the sub varsity level. And the first year, you know, honestly, I didn't do a very good job. You know, a lot of it was about competing and why not us? And, you know, it was too results based. And that's where I think that the big change has come over the years, is more appreciation for the process. But it was about results there, and trying to instill a belief that, you know, we belonged, to be honest. And so changing that culture and raising expectations and standards. And so we were able to win 6 games that first year, and went to that district meeting and drew out the one team in the league that in the district that we probably could beat, and won the first playoff game in 31 years. And we were not very good, but there was one team worse than us. So we were able to get a win, and, you know, just kind of propelled some of that. But the best thing that I did that first year, and we still do it to this day, and I don't know where I got it. I don't remember why I did it. I think I was just trying to find a way to keep the kids busy while I did our exit meetings at the end of the year. But I had the kids write a letter, and it was an anonymous letter. They didn't put their name on it. They could if they wanted to. And we still do it. And I keep them. I love these letters. They've been so impactful to who I am as a coach and the way we run our program. But the first paragraph is the things that you liked and the things that you learned about the program and from the team that year and the season. And the second paragraph is the things that you would like to see changed and the things that the program and the coaches can do better to serve you as a student athlete. And then the third paragraph is any personal comments that you want to add that you think are important and what you think is important to next year's team being successful. And so I think, you know, on top of other, you know, other than the people I've met and the influences I've come across, these letters have been really impactful over the last 15 years. And we've done it at every level. And I have no idea why I did it, but I had some players there that had enough trust and the relationship was strong enough that I got torched. I mean, I got blasted in some of these letters, you know, and it was great. You know, I think that just from the program I came from and the people I'd been around, and probably being a student manager and having to run out and wipe sweat off the floor every time a player fell down, there was a little bit less ego maybe than some other guys as I received feedback. And so, you know, we just kind of periodically, I feel like I got better and we got better, and it was just kind of taking that feedback and not being offended by our players being honest, because ultimately that's what we should want. But that was definitely a like I said, I have no idea why I did it, but I'm so thankful that I have these letters. I still have all of them, and I it's really funny to look back at some of them.
So, oh, I'm sure it is. That's a great idea. I really like that. I think anytime you can get that type of feedback from your players, and especially, as you said, if you've built the type of relationship where they can be honest and it's not just all sugar-coated, but you can get their honest opinion, then I think and if you are open-minded as a coach, that you can take what is brought to you and see if it doesn't make sense to incorporate it into what you're doing. Do you remember anything specific, one or two things that somebody wrote to you that you said, oh yeah, that's a really, really good idea, or I do need to do more of that? Does anything stand out of suggestions that you ended up really taking to heart and putting into you know, what you did or how you changed maybe as a coach or incorporated it into, you know, the following season?
Yeah, there is actually. And the young lady, Becca Wiles, knows all about it. I've told her about it. I mean, she got married, and when she got, you know, married and when she finished college, I always kind of joke and reference winning to her. You know, when she got married, it was, this is your biggest win. And but she wrote in there, you know, that I would always, something along the lines, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but that I always told the girls they need to remember why they play and love the game. And she challenged me on why I didn't act and carry myself in a way that showed that I loved coaching and that I loved basketball. And I realized it was just because I was too competitive. I was just so ruthlessly competitive. It was the environment I grew up in, you know, competing with my brothers and my cousins and competing, you know, with my friends every day, no matter what we were doing. And so here I am in a program that struggled, and these kids are giving me everything that they have, and we're getting better. And I was too young and immature to understand at the time, and needed that letter to explain, you know, you're not going to go from winning 5 games in 3 years to going undefeated. But I genuinely think in my mind, you know, as a first year varsity coach, that, you know, we laced it up every game, and I was like, anybody can win on any given night. And I think if coaches are honest, that I know we'd like to believe that's true. It's not true. Not any team can win on any given night. There are some talent gaps that are so great that you're not going to win. And if you can't find a way to make those teachable moments, it's a problem. But when Becca wrote that in that letter, that was a real slap in the face. And I had some conversations with, you know, my dad and people close to me, and my assistant at the time was actually a dad, and his messaging along with, you know, I still remember, you know, Mike and I, his name was Mike. Mike and I talking about that. He's, you know, said these kids get years to play high school athletics. Let's make sure we don't ruin the experience. And so, you know, I think there's a balance between challenging kids and making sure you protect that wonderful experience they have to learn and grow and develop.
So is she seeing you as being too, for lack of a better word, just grouchy and unhappy throughout the season because of the one loss record and the competitiveness, and she just wanted to see you express some joy, maybe with a smile or with some words? Or what exactly was she looking for, and then what exactly did you do to make that change?
It was a while ago, but I think part of it was, I would guess, you know, kind of looking back on it, I think a lot of it was probably the standards just weren't realistic. You know, being a young coach.
Gotcha.
And this happens all the time. You know, it was stuff like coming in the day after we play, you know, one of the best teams in the state, and we're not very good, and we turn it over 35 times in a high school girls basketball game, and we're running a down and back for every turnover. Like, what are you doing? Like, let's play basketball. I'll get better at passing and catching, you know. But I was a young coach, and that's where, like I said, it was great to have an athletic director that could redirect me and help me figure some of that stuff out. But, you know, I think that, like I said, kids can, they have that special knack for sniffing out the BS. And she was able to tell that I wasn't, you know, I did really care about the kids, and she knew that. She had me as a coach before, and so I wasn't displaying that in tough moments. And so I'm still very thankful for that, you know, as well as many other of those letters over the last 15 years.
Well, it's kind of a nice window into how you're being perceived, because a lot of times, and again, this doesn't necessarily just go with coaching. It could go with anything in our lives. A lot of times, you know, we're kind of stuck in our own head, and we think that we're doing things a certain way, or we know what our thought process is, or we know where we're coming from. But the only thing that people outside of us can judge us on is by our actions or the words that we speak. And those could be different from the internal motivation that we feel, that can show up itself slightly differently. And so it's good to be able to get that feedback. I know, like, even if you think about, I don't know if you've ever done this, and I haven't had the opportunity to do it other than sort of accidentally, but I don't know if you've ever filmed yourself, you know, or watched film of yourself coaching, whether it's in practice or in a game. And I've never done that where I've specifically had a camera trained on me, but we've talked about this. Jason and I have talked about this on the podcast. I forget who we talked about it with, but just thinking about body language and just the language that you use. And it's, I think it's important to, those letters are almost a form of that, in that you're getting this feedback of the way that you're doing things. It's very, very honest feedback. And I think film of yourself doing things, you'd probably catch, I know I would certainly catch myself doing things that I'd be like, oh yeah, I really shouldn't be doing that. It doesn't really jibe with what my intentions are, but the kids only see me doing this. Like, my kids will always tell me that whenever something goes wrong on the court,
that I always put my hands on the top of my head, and they're like, "Dad, why do you do that? You know, we know you're upset. Like, why do you always do that?" And I do, but you just, those are things that I'm not intentionally trying to do it, and it's still something that comes out. They can only judge you by what they see, and I think that's what the letters allow you to do, is kind of get outside of yourself and see how other people perceive you.
Yeah, and that's a great idea. You know, I haven't done that either. What we have done is, from a messaging standpoint, because for us, everything we do, from an offensive system to our culture, everything has specific language. You know, it's kind of become a trendy thing, but Bob Ritchie talked about it 2 years ago at the Billis camp, and it, you know, really impacted me. So we went back and bought, you know, inexpensive lapel mics on Amazon and recorded workouts and tried to put to every action we run a single word term, and, you know, tried to make sure our messaging was the same, and took it as far as going to our strength and conditioning coach at our school. We're fortunate enough to have a full-time person, and, you know, him and I laughed, because here I am talking about when you hop to catch to shoot the ball or you know, to play, having two live pivot feet, and as you sweep to attack, don't load. I would say, don't load. And I meant, don't take the ball backwards to bring it forward. Well, then he's in the weight room, and what he calls an athletic position is a load. So they're up in weight room hearing, you know, make sure you load. And then right, come to the court, right, and I'm screaming at him, don't load. And so I love the idea of videoing, and that's probably something I'll steal this year, because I think it's a great way, not just for myself as the head coach, but, you know, to have a better idea of what it looks like from our assistant coaches as well. But we wore the lapel mic at workouts, and I had each of them do it. I listened to them on the drives to and from. That Houston traffic gives us plenty of time. And then our assistant coaches did it as well. And so it was a cool exercise. It was fun.
Yeah. I'm sure you learned a lot about just the way that you spoke, and again, the language and the things that you do. We just talked to Coach Lundy from Queens. Let's see, what was that? I don't know, a week or two ago. His episode went up this week, but he talked about having basically a dictionary that he creates for his team that has the language that they use for, again, lots of different things, whether it's drills, culture stuff, whatever. And they actually put it down on paper and pass it out to everybody in their program. So when you're a freshman and you come in, you get this book of, you know, Queens basketball language, which I thought was really cool to be able to, again, he's like, we want to make it almost like a cult where, you know, we're our thing and we have something special here. And I think language is a big piece of that. And when you're, you know, audio taping yourself and you get to hear that, you get to hear the type of vocabulary that you use, and you get to also make sure that it's a line and that you're using the same thing. And I think when everybody's on the same page, it makes it so much easier if you can just say, okay, we're going to, you know, we need a load, and everybody automatically knows what that means, as opposed to, every time we say that or every time we teach that skill, we've got to go through and explain it over and over again. Whereas if I can just use that one cue, if I can coach with cue words, it makes things go a lot smoother, I think, especially on the practice floor. And in a game where you just don't have time to give out a 20-second explanation of what needs to be going on, if you could just use those cue words, I think it makes you much more effective as a coach.
It does. And I think it allows you in practice to coach the way, to your point, to coach the way you have to coach in a game. And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of coaches, it could be a point of emphasis, and it's something I try to help our assistant coaches with a lot. But, you know, we're in our off season workouts right now. We have a freshman who, you know, she's pretty special. She's going to be a nationally ranked kid, you know, Power 5 kid. And she came for the first time, and she's our only freshman that'll be with our varsity. And we have a core group back that has been in the system and knows the system and has been at workouts. Well, our ninth grader is doing volleyball. She's a multi-sport kid, so that's good. But she came over for a workout, and the first day she was so overwhelmed because it felt so fast. And I really think it wasn't so much the basketball. She's a really good basketball player. It was the way we talked, the way we explained things. And we want to do a good job of teaching. Like, I would pull her to the side and try to teach and show her, but, you know, we want to play fast, but we want to communicate fast, and we want everything to have alignment. And so, you know, it was funny. We're jumping into offensive breakdown stuff, and it might sound something like me going, you know, okay, you're going to hit the corner, you're going to scrape, we're driving behind the scrape, get to two, we're going to burn, lift, hit, and let's do a one more to the corner. All right, let's go to work. You know, it sounds like John calling a football play. And right, our kids, you know, are able to do it. And so, you know, I really do think messaging is a way for coaches to gain an advantage, you know, in the way that you do things. And, you know, it's really fun, and the kids enjoy it. They like it. I mean, to Coach Lundy's, you know, I love the idea of a dictionary. We have our program guidebook that, you know, has everything in there, but I think that's awesome. It's something I just wrote down to go add. We have a lot of our terms in here, but when we get to the part about our system, I love the idea of putting that in there and giving a list of all of those terms and what they mean.
All right, well, let's talk about your program guidebook. Let's jump right there. We'll kind of jump ahead because I think it's a good segue into talking about that. You mentioned it a couple times. Talk to me a little bit about what that is. Maybe give a good solid explanation so that anybody who's out there listening can maybe incorporate this into their program.
Yeah. It's so we had, you know, we've always had binders, folders, different things that we give out to our kids each year. And we had a team here that, one game we went 25-10 one year. But I genuinely believe it was one of the worst coaching jobs that I've done. And I say that because we had a ton of talent, but where we really lacked is that I thought that our culture had been around, we had enough continuity that it was sustainable, and I didn't give enough attention to it. And so at the end of that year, you know, I ended up sitting down and just putting together a program guidebook that has photos and breaks down everything. It has sections that go over what's important to us, when the three C's, the important to us parts, our culture, our core values. You know, our culture for us is really simple. It came from Positive Coaches Alliance. It's how we do things here. I had a really cool activity I would encourage coaches to do that I heard from another coach was, you know, kids have 7-second attention spans. We talk to people in short segments, unless we're on this podcast. And so we go 25 words. If you had to describe your culture and your program values in 25 words, could you do it? And if you need more than 25 words, you probably need to cut out some of the things that you are listing as the most important parts of your program, because there's no way your kids are going to remember it. And so we have our 25 word description there, which is, it's about developing relationships and serving each other. Our process is more important than results. We don't develop goals. We focus on developing winning habits. And then our core values are listed. We break down each core value. We go through the three C's I stole from Greg White, community, classroom, and court. We talk about what it looks like with photos and with, you know, a paragraph description of each of those things. We talk about what winning the day is like. And we have little phrases in there. The one that our kids like the most is TCOEO. It means take care of each other. What winning practice looks like. And so it really just runs through everything, our standards, our team rules, our team contract. We theme our days, which I stole from PGC. And so we do Music Mondays, Teammate Tuesdays, Wisdom Wednesdays, Thankful Thursdays, Fun Fridays, and, you know, do something special. So each of those days are described, but really, you know, basically this is, if I were to have somebody take over the program because something happened to me and they had to fill in, I want to be able to hand them this and have them really get an idea of what we're about. And I want to make sure everyone's on the same page. And so I will share anything with any coach, but this is the one thing that I'm protective over. I will share this with any coach that will block out time and sit down with me so that I can do a good job of going through and explaining everything. Cause I just think that, I think it's the secret sauce. I think it's when your culture and how you do things and what you're about is the differentiating factor. You know, I do this stuff for Fast Model Sports, and everybody wants, rightfully so, we want to find plays and concepts, and we want to figure out, you know, what it is that we can do to help score more baskets or get more stops. And, you know, then I run a poll on Twitter. What are the top, like the biggest shortcomings for coaches? And there were four options. There was developing a culture, developing relationships, player development, and X's and O's. And X's and O's got 4%. You know, culture was 47. Developing a culture was 47%. Half the coaches out there think that that's the shortcoming. And I actually would agree. I think that that's something that coaches really need to be intentional about, and they need to decide what those non-negotiables are. So that's what that program guidebook is for us. And I think it really is the key to why we're having sustainable success. We're not good, you know, just every once in a while. You know, obviously you have to have a certain level of talent to be able to win games, but, Yeah, I think when you build a program, you've got to improve your roster or your talent. You got to improve your coaching staff and you got to improve your culture. And when you improve your talent or your roster, you're going to win more and you're going to have some success. When you improve your coaching staff, you're going to win close games and you're going to have consistent success. And when you get your culture right, you're going to win big and you're going to have sustainable success. And so, you know, it's a really long-winded way of breaking it down. But as you can tell, I'm really passionate about, you know, trying to get coaches to understand how important it is, because when I was a young coach, I didn't know, I didn't understand. And you know, and 15 years later, I think we're finally starting to figure it out.
Absolutely. So how do you share that guidebook with the players? Is that something that you sit down in the preseason and you go over the entire thing? Is that something that where they each have the guidebook and when situations arise, you pull it out and read this paragraph or this page? How do you go about sharing it with the players?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. So every player has their own copy of it, and they keep it. You know, once the kids put in what they put into the program, you know, as all coaches will tell you, we want kids to take what they learn from the program and carry it with them. And so they're taking this program guidebook with them, and we'll go through the whole thing. And I really try to highlight and write specifics on the board that, you know, we're going to touch on every day. It's a lot of information. I know they're not retaining all of it at you know, that particular moment, but then we'll use our theme days to circle back and touch on it. And really everything we do in practice, our challenge as a coaching staff is to tie it to parts of this book. And so, you know, when we're doing Teammate Tuesday, we might do an activity that is about building relationships and getting to know each other. Hey, that's one of our core values. So we really need to make this important and meaningful, because relationships is a core value for us. And Teammate Tuesday is about getting to know your teammates. Wisdom Wednesday for us. There's times I might grab the guidebook, or I might find an article and ask how it relates to a core value. Or, you know, I talked about some of those phrases we use, and TCOEO being one of them. Be where your feet are being another one of them. And, you know, it's funny with kids, they joke about it, you know, cause a lot of times these things aren't cool, you know, necessarily, but I really enjoy, cause they'll use the phrases, they use them regularly. And, but it starts with our coaches. You have to be really intentional about connecting what you're doing to your program guidebook, or even just to your core values, just simple as that. Pick three core values, three things that you, there's two ways to decide your core values. What are the things I can't stand, or what are the things that I can't be successful without? Like, it's either what you don't like or it's what you like, and go off of that. But you create your core values. And so that's what we do throughout the year. And then occasionally when we have to do, like, for example, if I'm ordering gear and I'm asking the kids what sizes they want, I'll do a Google form. And on that Google form, it will ask their shirt size, their pant size, whatever it is that we're ordering. And then I'll put two or three questions. What's your favorite phrase that we've had in the last 2 weeks in a practice? What's one teammate that has done a great job of taking care of you? You know, anything that relates it. And so I think that's really what it is. But we do sit there because it, like I said, I know they're not retaining this whole program guidebook when we sit there, but to me, it delivers the message that you don't get to touch a basketball and take the floor until you are willing to sit here and understand what we're about. And then throughout the year, we have to make sure that some of this stuff sinks in.
Okay. So what would you say, and I already know the answer to this, but I want to hear it said out loud. What do you say to a coach who looks at that guidebook and says, you know, I don't have the time to go through that. I only get so much time on the practice floor. I'm not going to waste our practice time working on all this culture stuff and having Teammate Tuesday. That seems like that, all that touchy-feely stuff, that's not for me. Make the case for why it's so important. What would you say if you had a conversation with a coach who asked you that or made that statement?
Yeah, I think it's really about quality control for your program. And you know, it's cliche, it's the old saying, you know, the idea that kids don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And in this generation, it's becoming more and more impactful. And I am so anti the bashing of the kids these days. And I think kids these days are great. I think the reason why some adults have a problem is because they ask why and some coaches aren't confident to answer why. And so, you know, to me, I think this stuff is really important. And I think it, what it does is it develops the relationship and the trust and the buy-in that you need to really be able to push kids. And anybody who says it's not important, I hope we're in a close game late in the year. And then after the game, I'll explain to them why it's important, you know, and I think you just have to have conviction in what you believe in. If a coach doesn't think it's important, I just hope they're super, super talented and that there's never a close game where they deal with conflict and crisis. You know, I don't think any of us would go through a relationship in our family and call it a great relationship without investing time into it. And so to us, it's really important. Like I said, I think that the only thing, and it says this in our guidebook, the only thing that we would ever put before our players is our culture, because our culture is what actually protects the players. And if you don't clearly explain your standard, you can't expect kids to do it. And that's ultimately what this is. This is our standard. You know, that's why it's important. You know, you don't go to your team and say, you know, hey, okay, cool, we're going to go and we're going to run five out read and react, or we're going to run four out one inch true motion. Okay, go do it. They have no idea how to do it. And this is no different. Kids don't know how to be great teammates until you teach them. I mean, Mike, we do silly stuff in our program, and I say it's silly because people will think it's silly. We have all these team building activities so that I can see our kids do things that I want to hold them to. So one of my favorite activities is we play rock, paper, scissors. Everybody find a partner. You play rock, paper, scissors. It's best of three. If you and I are partners first, Mike, and you beat me, I'm your hype guy. I'm cheering you on, and you go find somebody else who won, and we play it out till we get one winner. The gym goes crazy. The kids think it's funny. They're jumping up and down, cheering, hyping each other. It looks like a hip hop rap battle. That's what it looks like, or a dance. But you're playing rock, paper, scissors. When the thing ends, it's really easy. I say to the kids, now when I watch film or I'm on the bench, you can't tell me you don't know how to be a great teammate on the bench, because I just watched you do it. And so everything here is just making sure we cover our bases and express our standards.
I can vouch for that activity being really good, because I've done it with both my daughter's team, AAU team that I coached. They were in ninth grade last spring, and so I did that with them. They loved it. My son, who is in eighth grade now, but when he was in seventh grade last spring, did it with his team. They loved the rock, paper, scissors game. And so any coach out there, I would highly recommend that. That's fun to do in any – it's fun to do in any setting. You get a group of adults, mm-hmm. you know, to sit in a room, and you know, things are going slow. You're ever given a presentation, just pull that game out, and I guarantee people are going to be smiling and cheering and jumping around and having a great time. That's a really good one. Another one that I tried, I don't know if you've ever done this one, but I forget where I got it from, but it's called the activity. I just call it podcast. And what you have to do is you pull three or four kids up to the front, and they're the podcasters, and the people who are not up in the front, they share a topic. And so then you point to one of the people who's up there, that's the podcasters. And I might say trees. So I point to someone, and then that person has to pretend like they're an expert on trees. And so they start talking and telling everything they know about trees. And then somebody else in the audience suggests to someone else another topic. Sometimes you can have two people or three people talking at once. Sometimes you can point so there's just one person, but whoever's up there has to be an expert in their topic. And of course you get all kinds of goofy topics thrown up at people. So again, it gets kids out of their comfort zone. It gets those kids who maybe are a little quieter. They've got to get up in front and talk. It gives the kids who are loud and, you know, like putting on a show, it gives them a platform to be able to do that. And again, by the end, everybody's smiling and laughing, and it's a great way to put things, you know, to bring them together, just like you described, in a way that helps to build that camaraderie between the teams. So that's another activity that I've done that I really like. So hopefully coaches out there, if you haven't tried either one of those two activities, you know, highly recommend that you go out and steal those from us and put them to use with your team.
We might
for
have
sure.
to start trademarking them, like LeBron trades Taco Tuesday.
There we go. There we go. Yeah. Just put together the book. all right. So let's talk about some of the other things that you've done in your career besides just your coaching gigs. Talk about your time with the Bulls. How did that come to be? And explain a little bit about what you did while you were working for the Chicago Bulls?
Yeah, the interesting thing, I always get the question, you know, hey, how do I get into NBA scouting? How I want to do it. You know, I think that's awesome. And it is, it's awesome. So here's the key. So everyone knows, get your pens ready. What you do is you find a kid from a small town in Michigan and you put him on your first AAU team and you coach him. And he's got to be a mediocre player. He can't be good enough that he goes on to play like a bunch of college and professional basketball, because you need him to get into an internship with a professional team and prove his worth. And so that's what happened. It's silly. Paul Miller was a former player of mine in our AAU program. He's the video coordinator for the Chicago Bulls. And you know, I was doing a lot of the stuff with Fast Model. And I really do. I love, you know, the culture stuff is a passion of mine, but the X's and O's is something that has always come pretty naturally. And I enjoy studying it and, you know, getting into it. And so Paul called me and said, hey, we're one of the few NBA teams that uses regional scouts for all of our scouting, and we need somebody in the South. And so I ended up covering 5 arenas for the Bulls. I covered Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Oklahoma City, and New Orleans. And anytime somebody played in those arenas, you know, within a couple weeks of playing the Bulls would send me to do the advanced scouting, and I'd try to steal signals, steal calls, diagram the after timeout plays, and try to make Paul's job a little bit easier on the film. You know, keep a call sheet so that, you know, Paul could go to the film and know exactly when he needed to clip stuff up. And just an awesome experience to learn. I mean, I got to sit down by the floor and watch the best coaches in the world. I've told Paul numerous times, the Bulls are terrible negotiators, because I would have paid them to do that as opposed to them paying me. But it was really cool. I did that for 2 years. And then, you know, with the coaching change, the Bulls went away from regional scouts, and but talking to those full-time advanced scouts, I mean, those guys are absolutely incredible with their knowledge of the game and being able to pick up tendencies. And I think I do a better job of scouting and stealing points at the high school level because of that experience. And, you know, obviously learned a lot about, I mean, just shoot, you're sitting there at the scores table watching Rick Carlisle in a tough season deal with players who are frustrated, you know, and getting to see what that looks like at that level. And, you know, obviously then the X's and O's, it's the best coaches in the world doing what they do. It was really cool.
What's in your mind, what's the key to being able to be a good scout, whether that's scouting like you did at the professional level, or when you're just going out to scout a high school game? What makes for a good scout? What should a good scout be looking for? What do you specifically try to pick out when you're scouting? What are the things that you're looking for?
Yeah, so the roles are really different. So I'll kind of touch on both. So when I was with the Bulls, I think that the number one thing is just recognition, being able to identify what you're looking at. And so that was something, you know, I was pretty honored to have the chance to do it. So, you know, I got NBA league pass, and I was trying to study film and watch, and yeah, I wasn't shy to ask guys questions. I think one thing that was interesting to me was being a regional scout. You know, initially a lot of the full-time advanced scouts, you know, they don't really like you a whole lot because you're taking a job from somebody else is the way it's kind of perceived. And I finally had a guy tell me that, cause I was asking him questions, and he finally was like, look, I really don't want to talk to you. You're a regional guy. I was like, all right, you're going to have to explain what that means, cause I'm pretty obnoxious. I'm going to keep asking questions. And so he, you know, laid it out for me like that. But it's really recognition, being able to quickly identify it, and have a process to get the notes down. And that just took being there. You know, a great story with that was, you know, the Houston Rockets are so simple in what they do, and they don't, you know, they play out of ball screens, and they do have some calls, but I went and, you know, had really rough seats the first time I scouted the Rockets, couldn't see a whole lot. And I ended up just, I couldn't figure out what the heck they were, like, what they were running. So I just ended up deciding on a whim to chart all of the different types of ball screens and locations of the ball screens. And I called Paul after the game, and I'm like, Paul, I have no idea. I didn't see a single play call other than they ran like a stack 25 and a stack 52, like Spain ball screen stuff. And like, that's it. And Paul's like, well, did you see Harden point? Like was he pointing? Yeah. He was like directing people where to go. No, Doug, that's their play. That's point. And so then I go back and I, you know, get on League Pass and I look, and sure enough, when he does it, it's a double stagger action. I'm like, oh, you're an idiot. Like, I had no clue. You know, it was my, like, probably third game ever doing it. And so, you know, in that, you know, realm, that's where that, the recognition is really the key there, and being able to identify those things. With the high school team, I think there's different ways to go about it, or at the college level. I like to view it as stealing time or stealing points. Like, my goal when I'm scouting an opponent is I either want to find ways that I can steal their preparation time, or I can steal points from them. So ways that we steal points, we're huge on defending baseline out of bounds plays. Like, for us, we were plus 6.5 a couple years ago. It was our best mark. Last year, we were plus 5.3. And in both of those years, we won a lot of close games. That year I talked about being 25-10 was the only year in my time here at the Village School that we had a losing record in close games. And, you know, a lot of that was our attention to detail. I talked that culture slippage, and we weren't great at those things, but we want to steal points there. Are there specialists? Are there, you know, do they have two kids that really are catch and shoot kids that average 12 points a game? Shoot, let's hold them to 6. We're plus 6. We just stole 6 points. You know, we script our first 3 plays of games. So I might see a team run a set that has an Iverson cut, you know, guard cutting over the top of the free throw line. And I might see, okay, cool, they're chasing over the top. Cool. One of our script plays is going to be that we're going to curl the second screen and we're going to get a layup on a back cut. Sweet. I just stole 2 points. And so that's one thing we do. And the way that we steal time a lot of times is, and you know, we have some good coaches in our league. I don't mind sharing it. We've had these discussions, but if they're coming to scout us and we're winning a game pretty comfortably, honestly, I might call timeout and say, hey, okay, let's go. We're going to do a 3-2 zone. I know we never really run this, but let's run it. The first pass, I want you to go trap. It's a new wrinkle that we're absolutely not going to run, but he might spend 10 or 15 minutes in practice going over it. And now he's not preparing to deal with our run and jump press because I see you in the bleachers or I see a representative there scouting. And I have the ability in that particular game to steal some of your preparation time. And so in scouting, that's just how we view it. You know, I know other people, they're going to look at a bunch of actions and do a great job of that. To me, it does not matter at all what I know. Like, I'm going to know a lot more than our kids, but what can I get our kids to do that does one of those 2 things? And that's been, you know, I think pretty good for us. And I do think it's a big reason why, you know, we've had a pretty good record in games decided by 8 points or less.
I love what you just said about stealing preparation time. It was 2 seasons. I coached middle school girls basketball, and 2 seasons ago I was playing a team that I was going to have to play in the tournament like 3 days before. So I told the girls, I'm like, hey guys, we're just going to run a bunch of stuff we've never run before today because we want them to think that we're going to run it in the game on Saturday. And we ran everything that was, because the seedings were already done. It didn't matter. It was just more or less, let's make them prepare for us. Well, we lost him the first time. We lost him the second time. Well, this guy definitely spent the whole time planning and game planning for what we ran in that game. And then and then on Saturday, we beat him after we lost to him twice. So yeah. It worked. You know what I mean? So it was kind of fun. And the girls didn't quite understand what we were doing until it actually happened. And then on Saturday, they were like, oh, now I get it. It was like light bulb came on, aha moment. It was awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's really effective. And, you know, we have a couple coaches that are really good in our league, and I'm sure they've done it back to me as well. And, you know, so then you're sitting there wondering, why the heck did I just spend 8 minutes, you know, going over that, and probably could have used that somewhere else. So.
Yeah, it's funny. All the little tricks of the trade, right, Doug? All tricks of the trade.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So how'd you get involved with Fast Model? Talk to us about that.
So obviously I was putting a lot of stuff out on social media. And I got to know Randy Sherman really well, was in his ramp program. I was one of the original guys in his ramp program, and Randy started doing some stuff with Fast Model. And so Randy talked to a guy named Justin Scanson, and Justin contacted for March Madness. Shoot, I don't even know. It would have been 4 or 5 years ago maybe, and asked if I'd want to, you know, do some coverage there. And then I just asked him, I said, hey, could I put like a weekly series together? I think it'd be really neat. We'll call it Plays You Can Use. And I did it every Monday, and we did it for three or four months. And it became one of their, you know, most popular blog post series that they had done. And they just kind of kept throwing me projects and things to do. And I don't do as many of the blogs and stuff now that I have dynamic coaching tools, but I definitely still To me, it's the best software. I know there's some other software that's come out, but it's as good as it gets. They're ahead of the game. They do a wonderful job. It's easy to use for, you know, a youth basketball coach all the way up to NBA teams. And we used it with the Bulls. And so it's been a really good experience. And that's actually how I met, you know, Paul Biancardi and how I got involved in the Billis camp. They contacted Fast Model about putting the coaching development program packet together. And Skansen called me, and we're at a team camp, the only time we've gone to a team camp, and says, "Hey, I've got a project. Paul Biancardi is going to call you from ESPN." And Paul calls me, and we talked about it, and I ended up closing down an Applebee's till 2 a.m. in Marshall, Texas, and while our players were sleeping, and we had a, you know, 8 a.m. team camp game the next day, and finished putting the Billis packet together with the notes that Paul and I discussed on the phone. And then, you know, each year now we put that coaching development packet together, and you've been there. So, you know, we do the on-court progressions and the different ELO drill, heat drill, and we use Fast Model for all of those things. And I've gotten to go to some state association coaching clinics and present and do some different stuff. And I guess my favorite thing with Fast Model, it truly is a group of people who just love finding ways to help coaches. And it just aligns with, you know, some of the things that are important to me.
All right. So how does that lead into the start of Dynamic Coaching Tools? Talk to us about that and what the ultimate, what your mission is with Dynamic Coaching Tools, where you see it heading, what it is now, and where you see it heading in the future.
Yeah. You know, we're still kind of evolving Dynamic Coaching Tools, doing a lot of work behind the scenes, but the way it started. So my dad, he's doing great now. I mean, it's unbelievable. We're extremely blessed, but he battled stage 4 cancer twice, 2 different types of cancer. And, you know, recently, I guess, you know, over a year now, but he had a stem cell transplant, and, you know, just, it was a really tough time for our family. And I was doing some stuff with a high school teammate of mine, one of my best friends, through Hoop Grind Basketball, and they do a good job with player development. And so it was really kind of trending that way. And I told my friend, yeah, I think that's going to be the route you need to take this. And not that I don't enjoy that, but I really want to find ways to serve coaches. I want to do that. And my dad randomly, you know, I'm visiting him as he's going through treatment, and he says, "Hey, I don't know if you ever want to use it. I had this weird thought, when you were going and speaking at some different stuff. And I started an LLC called Dynamic Coaching Tools. And I just thought maybe one day it's something you might want to use." And he hands me an envelope with the information. And I'm like, okay, you know, didn't think anything of it. And I'm driving home and I'm just like, okay, this isn't an accident. Like, you know, I think this is something that is important. And for a long time now, I've been doing different coaching consultation stuff. I'll do Google chats with coaches. I don't monetize anything. I'm not a very good businessman, so I need to figure that part out. But I just love helping coaches. I
understood.
Yeah.
We can relate to that.
Absolutely. And so I go and I do these team sessions. So, you know, I've traveled to Phoenix for about four or five years in a row. I go to Michigan and I work with high school programs, and I'll contact coaches and watch some film and talk about, you know, the things that they're struggling with. And it might be implementing an offensive system. It might be developing toughness. It might be, you know, leadership. At our school, I was able to start a leadership development program that I'm hoping to, you know, expand on, that ties the administration of a school all the way down to their student leaders. And so, you know, it's really just evolving, but the core thing is, and I heard this in a podcast recently, that coaching is one of the most underdeveloped and undertaught, undercoached professions. I mean, really, it's, you're able to just put on a polo and go coach. And, you know, I randomly, I don't know why I use this example, but I was talking after hearing the podcast with our boys coach, who, you know, is wonderful, just a great guy, great person, great coach. And I told him, I said, you know, it's funny, it's, if you've played before, you can go throw a polo on and call yourself a coach with no experience or knowledge on how to coach. It's like walking in the hospital and going up to somebody and being like, "Hey, it's cool. Like, I tore my ACL one time and I had the surgery. So just lay down, relax. I got this." Like, you know, and it's what we do. And we don't prepare coaches for, you know, what exactly they need for the job. And, so that's where Dynamic Coaching Tools is going to go. I'm working on some different projects, you know, as far as helping coaches develop their own program guidebook. We're going to do some different workshops and events here over the next couple years, and just trying to figure out what it is that coaches need and what they're not getting to you know, help them out. And, you know, obviously the X's and O's will always be a part of it, because that's something I've done a lot of, but diving a little deeper. I'm working on some different models with talent gap, and you know, what are the things that develop a talent gap, and what are the methods to overcome that, and how do we systematically get coaches to understand how to do that within the framework of a program. And you know, hopefully I'm 15 years in and I think I'm figuring some of this stuff out. Obviously I want to get better every year, but I'd like to think other people could figure out what I figured out a lot quicker. You know, if I do a good job of doing what other mentors have done for me and sharing information and giving back.
What do you think is the biggest challenge out there for the average high school coach? What's their biggest impediment to success that either A, you can help them with, or B, just something that all high school coaches face? What do you think is the biggest challenge out there today being a high school coach?
I think it's, and I'm very specific in using the word systematically, but it's systematically developing your culture and being patient enough to allow it to happen. I really think that catches up to coaches. And, you know, the follow-up to that poll I discussed earlier, I asked coaches, 47% of coaches think that, you know, or they think that's developing a culture is the biggest shortcoming. Why is that? And I gave the choices of accountability, developing trust, just don't know how, and too worried about results. And a quarter of the coaches said they don't know how. And with the accountability, I think it's really simple. A coach who is panicked is going to make poor choices. It's the same thing we do when we're starving because we've been in the gym for 8 hours. We're going to go through drive-through. It's not the best choice, but darn it, it works for us. And so, you know, coaches tend to not stick with accountability because they don't have the patience to hold to their standards. You know, to me, you have to be willing to know what those non-negotiables are that you will lose a game for. And, you know, ultimately you win in the long run by willing to do that. And I think teaching coaches how to put those systems in place, you know, for me, it was being in multiple jobs where it's building from the ground up. I've never taken over a program where it's been already established and developed. I think that's something I've been really lucky. I'm realizing now I'm really lucky to have done that and been through that process. And so, it's a huge challenge for high school coaches and something that I think we need to figure out. I once again, tapping into another resource, that same podcast, you know, brought up the point. If I were to ask you, Mike, and I'll do the exercise on you, if you were a player, would you want to be coached like the way that you currently coach your kids? Like, do you believe that that's how you'd want to be coached?
I would say I would say the answer would be yes. I would want to be coached the way that I'm coached. I would want to be coached from somebody who A, cares about me, and B, somebody who knows the game, and then C, somebody who has an interest in my success, not just as a basketball player, but as a person. So that's the type of person that I would want to be coached by. Now, have I always been that coach? I would say probably not. I would say when I was younger, I was much more focused on results, just as you described earlier in the show, that how you were when you were a young coach. I was probably the exact same way. So if I look back at that, I would say that I probably wouldn't have wanted to be coached that way. I also think that you have a tendency, the less time you've spent in coaching, and especially if you've been a player, I think the more time you spend coaching the way you were coached, which might not even have been something that you enjoyed, but it's just what you know. And I think as a player, especially, you know, I'm almost 50 years old here, that during the time when I was playing, you really only could get the perspective of the coach that you were playing for. It wasn't like there was a whole bunch of information out there about how other programs were being run or what this coach was doing. So the only thing I knew was from the coaches that I played for. And so early in my coaching career, those were the types of things that I would do, is what they did. And even though I might not necessarily have agreed with all of them, it was all I knew. And gradually over time, like I thought I knew a lot more when I was 23 than I think I know now at you know, age 49, almost 50. Now I realize I don't know anything. But at 23, I thought I knew it all.
Yeah. And that's my point with this was, you said you would want to be coached by someone who coaches like you. So my challenge would be, who is coaching the coaches that way and helping them get to that point. Like, there are a lot of coaches that are not getting that coach. They're not being taught how to do it. And so obviously, you know, you figured it out and you're still, we'll all say it. We're all learn it alls, you know,
for sure.
To steal the phrase, but we have to find a way to help coaches get to that point. And I think that there are some times, if you were to ask your kids, you know, do you like the way your coach coaches you? Are there things your coach could do better? The problem is there's nobody telling the coach that. You know, that's my biggest pet peeve. Now, being an assistant athletic director for the last 3 years, one thing that I'm really proud of is I work for an athletic director that does tell the coaches that. You know, I've seen other administrators as I sit in meetings from other schools, and they'll complain about their coaches. And I promise they're not saying to their coaches the things that they're saying to us in the room. And I just think that's a shame. I think that's our job as administrators. And I also think that, you know, what you're doing with the podcast, what we want to do with Dynamic Coaching Tools, what a lot of people are starting to do, to the point you made while you were going through that, is we're all creating a lot of these resources to help coaches figure it out. And, I think it's just really important that we do that, because you can, there is enough need for coaches that you can walk over, buy a polo at, you know, the store, walk in and say, okay, what's your opening? I'm in, I'm a coach now. And I just, you know, I think education is something that, you know, we need to continue to offer to coaches.
I would agree 100%. I've said that numerous times, and I think coach education, I also think parent education, when it comes to being able to navigate the whole basketball landscape, is another area where I think the basketball system today struggles, where parents who are coming up, and if they have an 8-year-old kid, they really don't have any idea of how to navigate that whole system all the way up through, you know, making choices about what AAU program to play for. Do I need to hire a trainer for my kid? Do I just let them play? What high school do they go to? Okay, are they going to be recruited? There's so many things that I think parents need help with on the education front too, that if we could figure out a way to get good information in front of parents, we'd end up probably with better results for their kids. And by better results, I don't necessarily even mean that the kids would end up being better basketball players, but I think they'd end up with a better experience that would benefit them, not just in the moment, but as we've talked about throughout, kind of the theme of the show tonight has been, you know, as a coach, you want to have a greater impact than just what happens today on the practice floor or what happens on Saturday night at the game. It ultimately comes down to, you want to have an impact beyond what you can give your kids as basketball players. And I think if we educate coaches, we educate parents, and there certainly is opportunities to do that, then we're going to make the basketball landscape better for everybody who's involved in it. I think that's really the key. Doug, we're coming up on close to an hour and a half. I want to give you a chance before we get out of here to share your contact information, share how people can find out about Dynamic Coaching Tools and all the other things that you're doing. And then if there's anything that we didn't touch on, you want to leave as your parting shot, you can do that as well. And then we'll come back and wrap up the episode.
Yeah. I appreciate it, guys. It's awesome to have an opportunity to come talk basketball. I have 2 pages of notes. You know me, I'm the note guy at the Billis camp. So I've got a bunch of notes that I think I learned throughout our conversation, but coaches can find me on social media at Dynamic Coaches is our Dynamic Coaching Tools tag. Mine's just at Coach Brotherton. You can email me. It's coachbrotherton@dynamiccoachingtools.com. And I'll go one step further. If any coaches want to talk, I give my cell phone out on these things. You're welcome to text me or call me if you have questions on anything. It's 269-275-2812. And I just want to be a resource for coaches and help coaches out. And the only, I guess, parting shot I have, Jason, I've been waiting all day. I heard I was getting kind of a screwball question here, a wild card. I've gotten nothing. Every time you've talked, I've gotten a little nervous. You have anything, or am I getting off here easy?
Oh, man. I don't know. Okay. So when you were doing the scouting for the Bulls, what's the craziest thing that you ever experienced while you were scouting for the Bulls?
Ooh, craziest thing I can share.
All right.
That's a great question. I would say, shoot, that's a really good one. I don't know. I mean, there's been some different stuff. I think the thing coaches would appreciate the most would be Kyrie Irving was in Cleveland, and they went and played on TNT and got blasted by the Spurs, and Kyrie played really, really poorly. And this isn't crazy, probably in the way that you meant it, but it was really, really neat. And it just kind of shows why those guys are so elite and the best in the world. Kyrie came back out after they went to the locker room, and they're like taking down all the TNT production stuff, and Kyrie Irving's getting up shots. And I normally would leave. Like, I'd go back to my hotel, or if I was in San Antonio, I'd drive back. Well, I happened to be staying the night that night. And so I sat up there and did my report that I emailed to Paul from, you know, my seat, and they let me hang around, and he was on the floor for about an hour and a half. Like, I just kind of decided, like, I'm going to see how long this dude's going to stay. This is nuts. And so that was probably the craziest as it relates to basketball. Other than that, I would say, and I won't, you know, just to be respectful of the situation, there was a, and it didn't go to the media, which really surprised me, but there was a pretty quality scuffle in San Antonio between two teams after a game where, you know, one guy's trying to get to another locker room. And it's not one that got to the media, but that was pretty scary, because it was me and two other scouts, like, casually walking with the little snack popcorn they give us and a drink, and next thing you know, these dudes are huge, and you're like, this is not gonna go well if this gets out of control. I've seen what this looks like when it happened in, you know, Detroit years ago, and this ain't gonna be good. But it ended up being pretty tame. But that Kyrie Irving thing was, I mean, that was wild. I told our kids about it. I've told other coaches about it. It's just, I mean, just nuts.
Let's put it this way. I would sum that up by saying there's a reason.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why these guys are the best, you know, the best in the world. And sure, they're talented, and sure, they have, you know, they've been gifted with some physical tools that maybe the average person doesn't have, but you don't get to be at the level that Kyrie is, or any of these guys who are at the top of the league, without being willing to put in the time. And I think that's a great story to illustrate. And I think that's a great way to wrap up the episode. Like I said, Doug, can't thank you enough for spending the time with us. It was nice hooking up with you in person at Billis back in June. I'm sure we'll hook up again this coming June. Hopefully I can drag Jason along to this one. And we'll catch up down there. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our Academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.